Hello, book lovers. I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio and the Penn Faulkner Foundation. I write novels, and on this show, I get to do one of my favorite things in the world, talk to other writers about their brand new books. And if you're like me and get tired of seeing the same titles on every bestseller list, you are in the right place, because on this show, you'll hear from authors who aren't famous yet, but probably will be. Remember, you heard them here first. Today on my show, I am so excited to have Stacia Stark and her brand new novel, We Who Will Die. This is her first traditionally published novel. It's a slow burn romantasy set in a Roman-inspired world ruled by vampires. Sexy and terrifying vampires. Stacia, I'm so excited to have you here on my show. Welcome to Check This Out.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So on this show, Check This Out, we really highlight emerging authors. And this is your first traditionally published book. That means published by a traditional publisher going through the whole old school system. But you've been self-publishing since 2021. You've put out 12 books or novellas in that time. How did you go from self-publishing phenom to becoming this traditionally published author?
So I was really lucky. You know, the first step was always to get an agent, right? So I had gotten to the point where I was getting some interest overseas in my Kingdom of Liars series. Of course, I was like, this is a scam, and then found out that these were actual publishers, right? So
like a publisher just emailed you and said, can we publish you?
Yeah. And so I was getting offers for like that series, right? And I didn't know what I was doing. So, you know.
Like from actual known publishers.
Yeah.
Whoa. Okay.
It's quite common, like that's how we get picked up. But, you know, you need an agent, right?
I don't know. Do you? I mean, this is a new world.
You really do. I mean, I'm a big proponent of like sticking to your wheelhouse. And, you know, also, first of all, my agent is phenomenal. I'm so lucky. I don't know what I'd do without her. But this industry, especially moving from indie to the traditional side, there are so many differences and so much that you don't know until you know, right? When I started to get these offers, I pitched a few agents, ended up with my fabulous agent, Kim. She started shopping that series. And then, you know, we had a bunch of sort of overseas deals, audio. And that was around the time that I started thinking of this series, The Empire of Blood. And it felt like a trad series. I think all of us at some point are like, oh, it would be nice to see my book on shelves, which is really hard as an indie, right? Like we can do a lot, but we just can't do print and distribution. We went on sub in, I think it was like May. And yeah, it was on proposal too, which was a new ball game, right?
Yes, wait, we need to stop there, because usually fiction is sold. You write the whole book, right? And you send it out, you send it to your agent, and your agent makes some edits, goes back to you, you go back to your agent, and then your agent sends it out to traditional editors and tries to sell it. But you sold this book, We Who Will Die, on proposal. That means you didn't even write the whole book.
I think because a lot of indies have a track record behind us, right? Like publishers know we're going to write the book, right? Because we meet our own deadlines, and we can kind of point to our previous sales. So, it was very interesting though, because when you just have a proposal, you then have to kind of talk it up, right? Like everyone's like, this is phenomenal. You're going to love this. And you're really trying to sell it. Which doesn't come sort of naturally to me as a Kiwi anyway, but then you have to like put your money where your mouth is, right? So there's a lot more pressure, I feel like, once you've sold, because I sold the trilogy on sub, and I'm like, you know, handing over that manuscript for the first time was very scary.
Oh my God, that is unbelievable. We're talking to Stacia Stark, and we are going to talk about her brand new novel, We Who Will Die, which is her first traditionally published novel. Although I just want to go back, take another minute, because this is just such an incredible story. You only started publishing, indie publishing, right? Self-publishing in 2021.
Is that what it was? I'm like, it feels like I've been, and then, because I have been around and like, because it's quite common to have different pen names as well. This is my first urban fantasy romantasy pen name. But it's the first one that I was like, kind of, you know, found the level of success and everything that I wanted. And I was writing the books that just like called to me. And it's so funny that you say 2021. When I hear that, I'm like, that's crazy. Like to me, it was, you know, 2015 or something.
So when did you start publishing under other names? And can you share them? Do you want to share them?
I usually don't. Like, I kind of keep it separate. That's like very common with like indie authors. I really used, that was kind of, when was that? 2019 maybe, is when I sort of started that. And I really just thought of it as, you know, I think like a lot of people, I'd always wanted to write. And, you know, obviously traditional publishing has a lot of gatekeepers. I didn't know if I could write, right? You just don't know. And I think a lot of the time also when you start writing, you can know what quality is because you read all these incredible authors and then you're reading your own work and you're like, this is horrendous. But the great thing about indie is you get that automatic feedback in terms of royalties, right? So for me, I was like, right, I'm going to give this a go and, you know, sort of see where it goes, get that sort of real world kind of feedback. And the great thing about pen names is if it blows up, no one has to know. And I really just saw it as a chance to kind of almost teach myself how to write, if that makes sense. Like, as I was writing, you know, each book, it was sort of, okay, well, how can I iterate? How can I make that better? And I think that really helped me when I then turned my attention to Stacia.
And so does your publisher and your agent, do they all know who your other pen names are?
I don't think so. I feel like it was just, I mean, my agent does, but it was, they were only indie published. It was sort of a kind of hot genre at the time. And I'm kind of like, you know, when like your old work, you're like, I loved those books, don't get me wrong. But I think if I was to read them now, I would just be tearing them apart, right?
We're talking to Stacia Stark about her brand new novel, We Who Will Die. It's her first traditionally published novel. All right, let's dig into this book. It is so good. It's like Roman vampires, all the things. Tell me, what is your elevator pitch? How do you describe the book?
Okay, so We Who Will Die is an ancient Rome-inspired romantasy. When I was kind of pitching it, I was describing it as the love child of Gladiator and the Vampire Diaries. So 6 years before the book begins, my lovely heroine Arvel has lost pretty much everything that's ever mattered to her. She's in a very dark place and she's responsible for keeping her younger twin brothers alive. And one of them has this horrendous lung condition that she's just, you know, constantly trying to find medicine for, essentially. So, when a vampire comes and blackmails her with her brother's life, she's really got no choice at this point. Like, that's all she has to live for. So she enters this these kind of deadly trials called the Sundering, with the goal of getting close enough to the emperor to kill him. And, you know, she gets to the Ludus and realizes that some of the people are not who they seem, and it all kind of goes from there.
So in this novel, We Who Will Die, we have ancient Rome, we have the Colosseum, we have fighting to the death, and we have vampires. I mean, it is so good. Now let's dive into the actual book. Could you read from us and introduce us to this main character, Arvel? She is absolutely amazing. I keep saying that, but that's just because I can't get enough of this book. Let's meet Arvel. Stacia Stark's going to read from her new novel, We Who Will Die.
There's no worse feeling than watching someone you love die. The helplessness slices you into pieces, and grief sets those pieces on fire until you're nothing but ash. My brother's coughs rip through the early morning silence. Wheezy, pain-filled, exhausted coughs. I push the door shut behind me and reach for the salve, the tonic, the crystals. Stumbling into the wall, I curse and reorientate myself, aiming for his door, left open while he sleeps for exactly this purpose. Everyone's already sitting up in bed when I reach him, his thin body shuddering as he fights for each breath. I'm here. Pushing his shirt open, I spread it on his chest and neck, give him a crystal to hold, hand him the last lung tonic, and begin chanting. He reaches for the tonic, his eyes miserable. We can't afford this, he gasps out. Shh, drink it, Ev. Everyone swallows. I keep chanting, urging the crystal to glow just a little more, to eke out just a little healing power. I rub his back and his coughing begins to ease, each breath deeper than the last. That was a bad one. I'm sorry. I ignore that.
Do you think you can rest a little now? He nods, eyes already drooping. When he nestles into his pillow, I'm lightheaded with relief. These attacks are coming closer than they ever had before, and we can't afford not to have more lung tonic on hand.
So this is the setup for We Who Will Die by Stacia Stark. We have the main character, Arvel, who wants to save her brothers. She has these younger twin brothers, and the one has wounded lungs. He can't breathe well, and he's basically dying. And she's blackmailed by an evil vampire. It says, I will cure your brother if you fight for me and if you kill the emperor. And she takes the deal. So that's sort of the plot in a nutshell. But underneath this, right, are some very real, very serious themes. And I think this is why the book is so good, because we have basically orphans taking care of each other. And we have Arvel, the main character, who was forced to become a parent because her own parent took her own life because she was an addict. Where should we start? Should we start with Arvel becoming the mother?
Yeah, you know, I wanted to explore, you're right, there were a bunch of themes I wanted to explore, and I think the parentification of eldest daughters was obviously one of them. For Arvel, you know, I was speaking to someone the other day, and they said one thing that they found really, you know, that hit home for them was the scene where she's about to go fight in the sands. It's kind of a flashback. And she has to ask her mother to just watch the boys, right? That just that one day, that kind of feeling of like, I can't even trust you to do this, but like, I've got no choice, right? And just seeing the reversal of like, who is the parent in that situation? And so, yeah, I really wanted to explore that. And it's obviously one of Arvel's sort of wounds that she's going to be figuring out throughout the series, because it really has shaped into who she is. But at the same time, you know, that kind of responsibility and, growing up, I think, with that constant stress as a child, where your brain's kind of not, you know, set up, wired to handle it, it does leave some marks. And so that's kind of what we see, especially in book one.
Because Arvel doesn't really have a childhood of her own. She's forced to fight for the family, literally risk her life to fight in front of the emperor so that she can possibly make enough money to save them. And then she's safe. She's forced to become a parent before she should. And I think that's why books like We Who Will Die and Romantasy succeed and do so well with readers, is because this is a universal theme. And this is a way into it that is maybe a little bit easier than just laying this out, you know, in the known world, right? By creating this romanticy, this fantasy world, it's a little bit easier, I think, to get to Arvel. Do you think that's right?
I do. And I think the great thing about romanticy is the stakes are so high. And when the stakes are high, that's when you see what people are made of, right? And so, especially in these kinds of situations, yes, romanticy, we have all of the fun tropes and the romance and all of that, but there's just so much underneath in most of these books. And so I obviously get on my high horse when people kind of, you know, are writing off romanticy, when we are, so many of us are tackling these themes, and readers are, you know, really messaging us and talking to us about how much it has helped them go through similar stuff.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. My guest today is Stacia Stark, and we are talking about her brand new novel, her first traditionally published novel, We Who Will Die. Stacia, before the break, we were just starting to talk a little bit about these universal themes and how you get angry when people poo-poo romanticy, right? Because they're not really giving it the respect that it's due. I 100% agree with you. These are some heavy books and heavy themes, and I really want to talk about them because that's what drew me into the book. So we're still talking about Arvel. She's the main character. She's the one who's going to save her brothers, who's forced to become a parent when she's far too young. And the reason that she becomes a parent is because her mother is an addict. So you made up the drug that she's addicted to, right? And that doesn't really matter because it could have been crack cocaine. But you made it a little bit easier because you made up the drug. But let's talk about that addiction that is at the core of what tore the family apart, because that's really where this novel starts.
I think one of the things I wanted to tackle is the family of addicts, right? Because often we talk about, you know, addicts themselves and their journey. But I think there's a lot to be unpacked in terms of the people around them, right? And that kind of hope and disappointment and that cycle.
And so that was really what I wanted to sort of delve into. With our vow, I mean, one of the reasons actually that we have vampires in this book is because of this core kind of wound that she has. Because, you know, in exploring addiction, vampires are a great way to do that. We see, you know, they want the sun. They can go crazy for the sun, essentially. We have the kind of blood hunger and all of that. And so she's going to be forced to confront this throughout the series as she kind of sees all these vampires. And so, you know, I think as authors, we like to, I always say we find a character's wound and then we just sprinkle salt on it.
Yes. And, you know, some of the vampires are very sexy. But at the same time, we keep coming back to this idea of addiction with the vampires, too. Like you said, that they are addicted to the sun, some of them more than others. And Arvel, who had the mother who was also an addict, sort of goes on around this world that you've created with these goggles on, saying, like, I recognize an addict here. I could become an addict if I'm not careful, right? It's always in the back of her mind, these questions of addiction. And they're very powerful and very deep questions in this world that otherwise seems a little bit lighter.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, that as we were saying, it's one of the things I love about romanticy. We get to explore these themes, and especially in a series, we get to really carry that through, because people, you know, often within a book, people aren't going to, these characters aren't going to fully resolve their, you know, whatever is driving them. But throughout a series, we're going to see the ups and downs. And I think that is a core part, especially for Arvel and a lot of family members of addicts, is we know addiction runs in families, right? And even in this fantasy world, they know that that is the case. She is constantly going to be thinking, right? Is this my destiny? Am I going to be like this?
Let's talk about the world that we find Arvel in. She comes from a family of addicts, or a mother who is an addict, and she's thrown into the arena, which is basically like ancient Roman arena. She's like a female gladiator. Tell us about the world that you created in We Who Will Die.
So I did classics in high school and loved it. Wasn't the best student. Didn't know at the time, but I had raging ADHD. But, you know, it's that whole kind of interest-based dopamine. When I was in, right? Then in my 20s, I was lucky enough to go to Rome and stand in the Colosseum. And I just remember it was one of those pinch me moments, right? Where you're standing there, you're like, I can't believe I'm here. It's so huge. And I just, you know, I remember fixating on what it must have felt like to walk out into the arena. It's funny, I just made this connection now. I did Taekwondo growing up and fought, you know, I would just like national competitions and stuff like that. And I would be like in the bathroom vomiting. And no one was going to like fully hurt me, right? But like, this was just going, you know, into like a normal competition, right?
Right, right.
Or like when I think about that, and then I think about what it must have been like to walk out and be like, there's a pretty good chance I could lose my life. That just always kind of called to me. And so I just kind of tucked it away in my brain. And it wasn't until as I was writing, I think it was the last book in my Kingdom of Lies series. You know, it's one thing to have a world, but you need characters in that world. And so once you've got the characters and you know what people want, then things start to roll.
We're talking to Stacia Stark about her first traditionally published book, her brand new novel, We Who Will Die. The world is Roman-styled, Roman-inspired, with vampires. But again, what makes it so universal is that when you stand in the Colosseum, when a gladiator goes, right, walks in the sand, basically, she's out there to die or to kill somebody. Those are the choices. And these two universal themes that really, really hit home for me were, you have the play, the overlay of power, an emperor forcing this to happen. And then you also have all the people who have filled up the seats, who are watching this spectacle, who think this is entertainment. So where do you want to start, Stacia? Should we start with the theme of power? I mean, there are a lot of levels there. Or should we start with this theme of the enablers, all the people that are watching that find this to be entertainment? Where do you want to go?
I mean, there's a lot to unpack, but I think that you're right, that the spectators was always something that I was very focused on, because I remember thinking, even as a teenager, like, wow, this was the entertainment, right? Like, they weren't going to the movies. Like, this was it, right?
Right.
And the idea of, like, kind of finding, like, joy and interest in such brutality is, it still kind of shakes me when I think about it.
And so I wanted to explore that a little bit. And Arbel often refers to the spectators and their enjoyment. Throughout it, we really do see that it's ultimately for the emperor's entertainment, right? And it always was. These are just kind of little sims to him. They're not people.
Yeah. So I actually also studied Latin in high school and read a lot of these texts about gladiators and, you know, killing lions or different animals or people, slaves. And it has always shocked me because, you know, when you're watching a movie today, no one's actually dying. And you see no animals were actually harmed in the making of this film, right? But back in Roman times, people went to watch real blood flow. Like, how could that possibly be entertainment? Where is that world? Like, you had to put us in there and you had to get your head into that, right? That is just such a deeper level, I think, than just turning on a TV.
No, you're exactly right. And I think that was one of the main things. I really wanted to put myself in the headspace of someone, you know, in the crowd. And it's kind of that, you know, peer influence behavior. Like, we know groupthink, even on a minuscule level, is so dangerous, right? But then when you make it sort of part of a culture, even if people were to, in some small part of themselves, have a problem with it, they never really, you know, no one's going to do anything about it, right? And so, yeah, I mean, I remember thinking the betrayal almost I would have felt personally of standing on that sand and in this, like, the worst moment of my life and seeing, like, the joy on people's faces. That was a big part of this for me, for sure.
Yeah. And the humanity there on so many different levels. We're talking to Stacia Stark today about We Who Will Die. You're listening to Check This Out, and I'm Rachel Barenbaum. Let's go to the other side of what's happening in the stadium, which is the power side. So in your novel, We Who Will Die, there are many, many levels of power. There's the power of the emperor himself, who's putting, I mean, kids at this point, right, into the Colosseum, into the ludus to fight to the death. But also the characters on a very basic level are born with different levels of power. So you have mundanes, sigil marked, and vampires, right? You can do this in romanticism where you literally mark people, right, to say how where they are in the power spectrum. And you can't really do that with regular old humans. So let's talk about that.
Well, that was one of the things that, that was exactly it. It was the marking of people. And I was always interested in what that does to a society. Like, if you can see at a glance how powerful someone is and how that shapes how they're treated and what they have access to and what you have access to and how you feel about that person and how they feel about you, like, they were all kind of themes that I wanted to explore. And so with Arvel, of course, she's a gold sigil marked, but hers, for various reasons, has not grown. And so it's like she's kind of at the edge of that neighborhood of having that kind of recognition and power, but she won't get it. And so that was fun to play with as well.
Just to cut in for 1 second. So the sigil marked are a class of people in your book, We Who Will Die, who have a mark on their forehead. And it could be gold or silver or bronze, and the size of it all translate to tell people how much power they might have.
That's right. And so, you know, Arbel and her brothers, I talked briefly about, like, the genetic chances of people being gold or silver or whatever. And so both her and her brothers are gold. It's just ironic because they're living this kind of terrible life in the thorn. Yeah, I just wanted to play with that. And then with the vampires, I liked the idea. They are kind of, they have the upper hand, right? The emperor's a vampire. You know, he has the sigil marked syndicate, the vampire council. We know who is kind of favored, but the vampires need the sigil marked to do stuff during the day for them. Like, they rely on them. And I really wanted to kind of have that push and pull as well, where they're at each other's throats, but there's kind of a symbiotic relationship there too.
And the vampires are marked in the sense that they have the fangs and the pale skin. So you know, as soon as you see any of these characters, like you were saying, exactly how much power they have. And so you have based this whole book on this idea of this power that you can see automatically. And that's a really strong way to look at a system, right? And a way to get into these bigger questions of who should have power and why. We have other markers in the real world that we use to look for power and to judge people right away. But you made it very plain, right, and clear in a different way. And there's something to that makes it much more accessible.
Right. I mean, you're exactly right. Like, we judge people all the time, and people are put into boxes and categories and have access to less in this real world. At the same time, you know, you hear stories about multimillionaires walking around in sweatpants, and so you'd never know, you know, whereas this is like, you know for sure, like, how powerful people are. And so I wanted to sort of explore that, because ultimately, even though, like, the most powerful vampires and the most powerful sigil mart, it's all just an illusion of power, right? The emperor is in charge, and that's always been very clear. So there's no real democracy or anything like that, even though there's kind of the illusion of them being able to, you know, have their say in different ways and rule different parts of the empire.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. Last season, we spoke to Eliana Ramage about her debut novel, To the Moon and Back. That novel was named a Reese's Book Club pick, making it a huge seller. Congrats, Eliana. If you haven't read her book yet, check it out and listen to the episode wherever you get your podcasts or on nhpr.org. My guest today is Stacia Stark, and we are talking about her brand new novel, her very first traditionally published novel, We Who Will Die. So we've talked for a while about Arvel, the main character in We Who Will Die, and how she is going to enter the arena to save her brothers. She's been blackmailed by an evil vampire, Bran. And there's a very easy trope to fall into that vampires are evil. But then you have these two brothers, the Emperor's sons, and they are sexy and maybe evil, maybe not. I don't know. They're love interests. Let's talk about these two brothers, because also this is a very different family dynamic that you get at here. Very real world. Introduce us to Tiernan and Rorik.
Sure. So Tiernan is, you know, when Arvel gets to the Ludus, she quickly realizes that he's the primus. He's in charge of pretty much keeping the Emperor alive. And, you know, we see some flashbacks of him and her as children, kind of, you know, playing together and then growing into becoming lovers. And then he, on the worst day of her life, abandons her. So we've got a lot of backstory there, right? And then, you know, the first time we see Rorik, he's disemboweling someone.
Right, he's horrible. Literally ripping out someone's guts, ripping out hearts. Like, he seems like pure evil.
That's right, yeah. And he is, you know, like, as far as Arvel's concerned, you know, there's a woman in the crowd who's kind of lusting after him while he's doing this. And Arvel's just kind of sickened, right? And, you know, she sees a few different sides of Rorik throughout the book, but he's kind of pretty unapologetic about who he is. And of course, at the midpoint, I think we really see when he kind of tricks her into killing the wrong person. That's when she's kind of realizing, like, oh, I'm trusting the wrong people. Even though I've grown up in the Thorn and I thought I was kind of street smart and I've had to, like, you know, really grind and use my instincts. As soon as I got to the Ludus, I was a fish out of water and I let all of that go. And just kind of seeing him basically be like, well, yeah, you did it to yourself is, that was a fun scene to write.
Yeah, I bet. So these two brothers, you sort of have one, Tiernan looks like the good guy. He was the original lover for Arvel, the main character. And then Rorik, who looks like the bad guy. But I have to be honest with you that I think I'm team Rorik. I'm wondering if we have like a Rhysand, Feyre, Tamlin situation. I don't know.
It's funny seeing how, like, I was just in Australia. Actually, even on the American tour, people were like gagging for Rorik. And so, and I'm like, obviously, we know in romanticy there are tropes and, like, and all of that. And if you've read a lot of romanticy, a lot of people are like, oh, it could go in this direction.
Yes.
But I'm like, you take all of that out, right? And ignore all of that. You guys, he's a sociopath. What's wrong with you?
I'm hoping that we're going to see more of his good side coming up. I don't know what you're going to do in book two, but I sort of, in the back of my head, I'm thinking this guy has really been wronged by his family. And again, we get into these bigger questions of family dynamics that, yes, they're vampires, but this is a way for you to show how a father pits two of his sons against one another, how the father with too much power, the emperor, really destroys his sons. Let's talk about that dynamic and what you're trying to get at.
Yeah, so we see I think in one of the flashbacks, I have Tien and say, when he's young, like my brother, he kind of references his brother almost like worrying about him, right? So like we can see as children, they were close briefly, but it, that kind of brotherhood, it can't really survive when it's, you know, being under the emperor. When it comes to power, you know, they've both got very different motivations, right? So when I first pitched this book, it was only ever going to be a second chance romance. And, you know, that's not done very, very much in romanticy. And I really liked the idea of exploring that theme of how we change when we're apart and what that looks like when we've grown so different and try and kind of come together again. We really see that with Arbel and Tiernan. It's like that. I joke that they're trying to make fetch happen for some of it. But at the same time, they have this history and he's really looking out for her and he knows her so well, to a point, right? He knows the Arbel that she was. And for her, he's just kind of this like this stone that she can rely on. And Rorik, on the other hand, is unhinged.
I don't know, but this is where we get to it's romanticy, and people might write off We Who Will Die as some fluff because it's romanticy, because it's a love story set in a Roman style setting, right, with the Colosseum and vampires. But it's such a human dynamic to have two brothers fighting each other for their father's affection, right, and two brothers pitted against each other by a horrible father. And you really get to that dynamic. They both wanted their father to love them at some point and choose them, right? Choose them as the heir, and they're not chosen. Instead, he, you know, the father finds these ways to manipulate them so that Rorik goes against Tiernan and Tiernan goes against Rorik, right? And that's a very real family dynamic that you have unearthed there.
Yeah, and I mean, I think I wanted to not just kind of reference that, but sort of be like, I always think, like, what would happen to the average person in that situation? I think we all like to be like, oh, well, I would stand up to my father, or, like, I would never turn on my brother. But I think we see, you know, obviously several indications from the emperor of, like, who he is and what he's like on a grand scale. So we can only imagine what it must have been like for them growing up with that. But it's interesting to see, like, how that shaped each brother. And obviously they had very different motivations for why they're doing what they're doing.
But I love that you bring up this idea that, oh, I would never do that. I would never turn on my brother. I would never go against my father. Because in fact, most people might. And that human side you show, and you can unabashedly show it because they're vampires, because they're supposed to be bad anyway. Like, can you possibly have a good vampire? I don't know. Can you? Right. And so I think that that's what one of the depths that we reach in this book is, what would you do? What would a normal person who's not a vampire do in this situation? And you can talk about it through these two brothers.
Yeah, I agree. And I really wanted to look into, you know, one of the big themes is second chances in this book, in all kinds of ways. And so I think, like, we'll see going forward in the series, we will see sort of their relationship a bit more. And if they can, I feel like we are learning as adults now, especially in this world, sometimes just being born into the same family does not mean that you're going to be able to reconcile those huge differences or values or morals, right? And so that's one of the questions too that I want to explore, and I am exploring in the next couple of books, sort of what you can put aside and how that hurt can kind of just turn you bitter, if that makes sense.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. My guest today is Stacia Stark, and we are talking about her first traditionally published novel, We Who Will Die. Stacia, at the center of this novel, We Who Will Die, are vampires. The emperor is a vampire. His two sons are vampires. Arvel, the main character, is sigil marked, but not a vampire. She has some level of power that is growing, but she's falling in love with the vampires. I want to talk just for a minute about vampires, because they are, of course, made up. And yet there are some rules that you have to follow when you put a vampire in a book. Some that you can make up, but some that you sort of have to follow because they're already in the lore of what a vampire is. So how did you think about that as you were writing We Who Will Die?
You know, I think that's one of the things I love so much about romanticy is being able to take something and put it your own spin on it, right? And I do that with a lot of different like mythical creatures. It's like I'll learn the lore and be like, okay, so what do I want to keep? What do I want to change? And so because I had that theme of addiction and because I, you know, I wanted to delve deeper into like who the vampires were, I really liked the idea of them, you know, not just having turned vampires, but born vampires. So the thought of what it would be like to grow up and know that at some point you're going to lose the son and what that would do to you. And then obviously we've got this the sun tonics and all of that kind of stuff where that can also cause its own madness. And so I wanted to kind of have that vulnerability with the vampires so they're not just kind of ultimate power.
Yeah, but you had to create them. Like, you could choose what to include, what not to include. Do readers sometimes come up to you and say, oh, you missed this about a vampire? Or, like, I love what you added to the vampire. Like, because people who read romanticy really know rules about vampires and have strong opinions on it.
I've actually been, like, readers have really enjoyed it. The idea that they want the sun and they can't have it and that they lose the sun, I think, has been something that readers have really liked so far.
I think that's because it is an addiction. And that's where we get to the core of this novel is about addiction, right? The vampires are trying to feed their addiction. And that's why it's so universal.
Yeah. And we see it in so many parts of society in the book. And the vampires are just not immune at all.
Yeah. So we've already touched many times on the fact that We Who Will Die is your first traditionally published novel, that you had self-published your ones before. Now that you've gone traditional, are you going back to indie? Are you going to stay for a while? Where's your head on that?
So this is a 3-book series. It's a trilogy. So, you know, I'll have book 2 and 3 still have to come out. At the same time, I will also have book 2 from one of my indie series, Kingdom of Death, will be coming out. I think I'll always kind of remain hybrid. I think that it really is the best of both worlds. I think as an indie author, most of us are control freaks. And we're used to being very nimble and sort of doing things our own way. But at the same time, having been in trad, having a team behind you and working with my editor, like all of that has been great as well. So I think I can't imagine that I would go fully, now that I'm kind of playing in both worlds, I can't imagine that I would choose one.
Yeah. And also, interestingly, I've had other authors on this show who have made that leap from indie to traditional. And they said one of the things that they have not liked is how they're getting paid by traditional publishers versus an indie. You get paid royalties every month versus traditional publishers. Maybe you get paid once or twice a year. Have you been thinking about that? Does that affect your decision?
Yes. And I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why I would always want to keep my hand in indie. Because it's not just like a day-to-day control, it's financial control. When you're at the hands of a corporation, you play by their rules. You never know if something's going to go under, if payments are going to be delayed. I think it's, and that's why we see a lot of traditional authors have day jobs. And I think one of the reasons that a lot of indies get picked up is because they're already selling well, right? They're already making good money. And so most of the time, in fact, I can't really think of many times where an indie author has gone trad that I know of because of, say, the advance size or anything like that, right? Like, it really is about getting books in front of a whole different set of readers.
Wow. So what do you think the future of publishing looks like for romanticy books like We Who Will Die? Do you think that authors like yourself are going to be hybrid? Do you think we even are going to need publishers 10, 15 years from now? What's going to happen?
I mean, I think if indies had a model of print and distribution the way that trad does, trad would be in big trouble because we don't. I think there will probably, you know, there's, I mean, there also, we've got to remember too, there are a lot of authors who are just They want to be trained authors, period. They're not interested in, you know, trying to learn the run the indie ecosystem or the business, right? So I think there will always be a place for traditional publishing. I just think that some of the power scales are kind of tipping in terms of like some of these big hybrids who get to sort of pick and choose what they take.
Yeah. I mean, the biggest thing that I keep hearing again and again is this idea of control, the financial and the creative, right? And how you're going to price it, how you're going to market it, and when you're getting paid. Because when you're with a traditional publishing house, you're getting paid like once a year, maybe twice a year. And that's just not attractive when you're used to getting paid every month.
Totally. Yeah. And I mean, those royalty statements, it's like, I think they come out like 6 months after that 6 month period, but I don't think you actually get the payment then. And then with a lot of publishers, like especially overseas publishers, sometimes you're not actually getting paid when you think you're getting paid as well. And, you know, thankfully, like having agents, like that kind of helps, right? Like they're making sure that everything's happening the way it should. But if I was entirely reliant on trad income, especially in this economy, I would be probably, I'd be worried just because I'm such, again, a control freak.
But you bring in the agent too. The agent is on top of your payments because the agent gets a piece of what you're paid, right? And so do you need an agent if you're an indie writer?
If you're indie, no. I mean, if you want to be hybrid and sell to trad, I do believe you do. You know, yes, it's 15%, but I mean, my agent, like, she earns that and more because of her negotiating, because of her contracts. She is, I mean, I would be absolutely lost without her. And so it's like, yes, it's 15%, but what could you have gotten in that contract if you'd had someone, you know, also like the, you know, legal and you know, all of that kind of stuff. You don't want to be, because ultimately the reality is publishers, their job is to write a contract and terms that serve them. And so if you don't know what you need, what you can ask for, what is normal to be in a contract and what is just like, you know, they're just trying something because they know you don't have an agent or whatever, then that's, you're in trouble.
Stacia Stark, before we wrap up, we're talking about your amazing book, We Who Will Die. What advice do you have for new writers, either indie writers or people aspiring for the traditional route?
I think it would be to obviously read a ton in your genre. I think that's like a lot of the time I see people and they're like, oh, like I don't really read this genre, but it's selling, so I think I'm going to try. And I'm like, if you don't know the tropes of the genre, you're not going to be able to like twist them and, you know, call to what people want, right? And I mean, the other thing would be just to like write relentlessly. I think I see a lot of people who, you know, they've been writing the one book for 5 or 6 years. And they're like, I'm almost ready to take it on, you know, to try and get an agent or whatever. But the reality is your first book's very, very unlikely to be the book that sells, right? So I think being able to like shelve projects and do something new and play and try something different is going to serve you well as a new writer.
I think that's such good advice on both fronts, because I also hear a lot of writers saying, oh, I could write a romance, no problem. I'm just going to bang it out. And it's like, but those of us that read it will know within a page that you don't read and love this genre.
And then people will ask like, oh, like, does romance have to have a happily ever after? Like, I think that's predictable. Mine's not going to have a happily ever after. And you're just like, I don't know what to do
with this. Right. Like, I'm not reading your book if there's not an HEA or a happily ever for now.
In romanticism, I think people underestimate how hard it is to have a fully fleshed plot and a fully fleshed romance, right? Especially on that scale. And so when people just think, oh, I'll just jump in and you know, it's like a cash cow, which it's just so competitive, especially right now. I would like steer anyone away from it unless you've got a book that you're like, you know, this is it. This is what I want to write.
Stacia Stark, thank you so much for joining me on Check This Out. I absolutely loved talking to you.
Thank you. This has been so much fun.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum, author of the novels A Bend in the Stars and Atomic Anna. You've been listening to Check This Out, a show where I get to do one of my favorite things in the world, talk to other writers about their brand new books. Check This Out is a partnership between New Hampshire Public Radio and the Penn Faulkner Foundation. I'll be back next week with another new author you should not miss. Our producer today is Jessica Hunt. NHPR's program director is Emily Quirk. Our partner, the Penn Faulkner Foundation's mission, is to champion the breadth and power of fiction in America. The show is sponsored by CNS, Wholesale Grocers Family of Companies, the podcast Totally Booked with Zibby and Zibby's Bookshop, and the Jack and Dorothy Byrne Foundation. Remember to go to your local library or bookstore and check out all the books we're talking about this season. Thanks for listening. Read on.